It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Lydia Bastianich is one of the world's most famous chefs and a public TV favorite. Coming up, she'll join us in our studio to talk about some of the biggest challenges we can run into when we're cooking and how to solve them. Now, Governor Walker requested approval from the federal government last year to put rules into place that would make some work mandatory for able-bodied Medicaid recipients here in the state. It was an issue Governor Walker worked on for years and seemingly had the support of many in his base and from members of the Trump administration. But the rollout of the new rules has been slow, with some political watchers wondering if a tough campaign season might be playing a role. Our next guest has been following this topic and is here to talk about the role healthcare is playing in election bids in Wisconsin and around the country. Dan Diamond is the author of Politico Pulse, which covers healthcare politics and policy. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure to be here, Rob.
Well, talk us through the timeline. This has been out there for a while, these Medicaid work requirements that Wisconsin is asking for. How long has this been going on?
This has been going on since essentially the beginning of the Trump administration. So let's pull back a second, and I'll tell you how I came to this story in the national picture.
Sure.
Wisconsin is one of about a dozen states that have asked the Trump administration for permission to impose work requirements on Medicaid beneficiaries and make other changes that could really hurt low-income Americans. And Governor Scott Walker specifically wanted to drug test Medicaid beneficiaries, which he's pushed for other programs in Wisconsin, too, as well as require co-payments. Now, in some states, these requests have been approved. And I'd heard a few months ago that Wisconsin's approval was basically done, too. There was a story I wrote in August that broke some news about this, that Governor Walker's drug test request was deemed impermissible, that there would be a workaround instead for that. But many of the other changes that he wanted did get the sign-off. But as I've been waiting for the announcement, and even as the Trump administration's top Medicaid official publicly teased it a few weeks ago, what I've been hearing from the folks inside the administration is that Wisconsin was suddenly acting odd and less interested in this waiver than they had been for years. As one person told me, it was kind of a hurry up and wait. We want this done. And now that it's done, Wisconsin was being very nitpicky and creating reasons to stall. To be fair to the Walker administration, they have denied that they're stalling. They said that they've done everything that the Trump administration wants, and they're blaming the holdup on officials here in D.C. But I think the bigger issue is that Walker, like many Republicans around the country, is vulnerable on health care issues. And you saw some of that this week in Wisconsin as the Evers campaign really hit him on pre-existing conditions. So at this point, just a few weeks out from an election where a Democrat may well take over the state house in Wisconsin, and this Medicaid waiver that Walker wanted may never get put into law, there's a lot of mystery around why has it taken so long, and does the Walker administration even want this right ahead of an election?
So the sense you're getting from these federal officials is that, what, they could do this thing tomorrow as far as they're concerned?
That's my understanding, that the federal officials have had this baked for weeks and weeks and have been ready to announce it. Seema Verma, the head of CMS, about 3 weeks ago, stood in front of a Medicaid meeting and said, we have finalized the terms with the state. We're looking forward to delivering that, making it public soon. I was told by sources then, continue to be told, she was referencing Wisconsin. But as we get closer and closer to the election, there is some confusion on the part of Trump administration officials why this has taken so long. Because if in 3 weeks, 4 weeks, Scott Walker loses, there's significantly less likelihood that this waiver would even go through. And that would complicate the timing that much more.
Again, as you said, Walker administration officials say, no, it's not us, it's them. But with the politics of this, would this particular announcement, these work requirements for able-bodied people, some of the people who are receiving Medicaid, is this seen maybe as a losing political issue at this point?
Rob, that's a great question. I've been asking folks on the ground in Wisconsin for their take. I talked to a Republican strategist, Brandon Schultz, who said that the election at this point is basically settled into its camps, Republicans with Walker, Democrats with Evers, and that fight over independence in the middle. Polling on Medicaid and work requirements has been all over the map. A lot depends on how the question gets asked. If it's asked as a, should people be responsible and do things that warrant them getting these benefits, folks are supportive generally. Even Democrats are supportive of that idea. But when it's asked in a way where Medicaid is seen as contingent on things that might be beyond a person's control. And many of these low-income enrollees in Medicaid may not have the ability to get a job because they're working as caregivers for their ill parents, or perhaps they have mental illness. And even though they're physically able, it is harder for them to actually go out and work in the field. That has alarmed independents and Democrats significantly more. And if there is a political issue that is dominant across the country heading into the elections, it is health care. And anything that Walker has tried to do on health care has been quickly seized on by his opponents. So my understanding, having talked to some folks in Wisconsin, as well as some national folks, any broaching of a Medicaid topic that requires cutting back services or enrollment is something where a Republican like Walker would be vulnerable.
Talking to Dan Diamond about Politico, about health care and politics here in Wisconsin, and open questions about work requirements for people receiving Medicaid and when that would go into place. Dan, you mentioned this isn't just a Wisconsin story. You're seeing this healthcare politics dynamic from Democrats and Republicans in other states as well. Can you talk about how that's playing out?
Sure, Rob. I think healthcare has been the number one issue that Democrats have run on across the country. I spoke to a congressional candidate in Illinois a few weeks ago, Lauren Underwood. She's running against a four-time Republican congressman, Randy Holtgren, relatively popular in a district that has gone consistently for Republicans for years. In fact, Denny Hastert, the former House leader, came from this district. But Lauren has found that her campaign, which is built around Republicans' efforts to roll back the Affordable Care Act's protections, Underwood has said, I will fight for this. I'm a nurse. I'm someone who had a pre-existing condition myself. She's found significant purchase with voters, significant national attention on this race because she has made it about health care. And there are probably 50 other Democrats I could point to who have also built their campaigns around health care that way. One data point that has also helped Democrats is Republicans have supported Medicaid work requirements in states like Arkansas. But as those work requirements have come into place, thousands of enrollees in Arkansas have lost their coverage. And Democrats are saying, look, folks who support this idea of cutting back accessibility to Medicaid are going to be harming some of the most vulnerable people around the country. And in places like Florida and Georgia, there are governor candidates who have run not just on opposing work requirements for Medicaid, but expanding Medicaid too.
I know sometimes pollsters ask voters, which party do you trust more on a particular issue? And that includes health care. Do we have that kind of data going into election time this year?
We do. There was a poll that came out just a few days ago from the Washington Post and ABC News that showed that Democrats have significant advantage, over 15 points on health care trust from voters around the country. That's essentially the highest level since before the Affordable Care Act and when Democrats then took a lot of attacks for their health care strategy. That's different from race to race, but overall, Democrats are controlling the high ground on this issue.
This is an incredible reversal in some ways. If we go back to 2010, this huge Republican wave here in Wisconsin, I think more than anywhere else in the country, Republicans wanted to talk about health care and attack the Affordable Care Act. It seems like Democrats couldn't escape it in some ways. How have we gotten here from there?
It's an interesting path. When Democrats pushed through the Affordable Care Act, they left themselves open to lots of attacks. One attack was that this was a partisan reform. Now, I was covering, to some extent, the Affordable Care Act fight, and there were Republicans, at least at the beginning, who were open to the idea. Chuck Grassley, the longtime Iowa senator, was on board with the idea of the Affordable Care Act until it became this heavily partisan issue. But once Democrats passed it only with Democratic votes, that left them open to the attack that they didn't seek to compromise and that Republicans would have done health care better. Of course, health care is problematic in the United States before the Affordable Care Act and after it, too. Any health care problem that a patient might have experienced was able to be repurposed by Republicans in the years after the ACA and used as an attack on Obamacare. And for example, wait times at doctor's offices, that's been an issue for decades, but Republicans were able to say, this is a problem that the Obama administration made worse. And we would have done a better job if only they had worked with the Republicans to pass the bill. One reason it's flipped is now it's Republicans who are in charge. And they cannot make that same kind of argument, especially when their healthcare reforms have been things like trying to roll back parts of the ACA that people really like, the protections for pre-existing conditions, some of the support that would have made shopping on the Affordable Care Act marketplaces cheaper. One reason why premiums have gotten higher in recent years is because Republicans have taken out pieces of the ACA that were designed to subsidize purchasing these plans. So Republicans have both become the folks in charge of overseeing the law, which makes it harder for them to attack it. And at the same time, the things that they have done have given Democrats real issues to point to and say, look, Republicans don't have Americans' best interests at heart at healthcare, because just look at their track record here.
We'll leave it there for now. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
Dan Diamond is the author of Politico Pulse, which covers healthcare, politics, and policy. He joined us to talk about Governor Walker's plan to impose minimum work requirements in order to qualify for Medicaid and why the plans seem to be on the back burner. Cooking a new type of meal can feel really rewarding when it goes right. Getting up the courage to try something new in the kitchen and dealing with mistakes along the way can be a different story. Even for the best of us, maybe there are still new challenges out there. And we're joined right now by one of the best in our studio. Lydia Bastianich is a chef, public TV host, and author of a lot of books. The newest one is My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food. Lydia, welcome back to Central Time.
Buongiorno, Rob.
Well, thank you so much for coming over to the studio today. Now, you've been at this for a while. You've been cooking for a long time.
Yes, I've been cooking for 47 years, and I've been on public television for 20 years.
Right. Is it still possible for even for you to find something new, a new challenge or a new wrinkle in the kitchen?
All the time, Rob. That's the excitement, you know, in being, I think in any business, if you cannot be challenged by something new and continue to grow and then ultimately share it, then I think, you know, it sort of fizzles off. So, you know, what are my challenges? Certainly, I love the seasons, and there's always something new with the seasons. And, you know, you were talking about cooking, and I would recommend to stick with the seasons. The products of the seasons are at their best, usually most economical, and yield a good meal.
And we're going to be talking actually on a food segment tomorrow about cooking with winter squash, very seasonal right now. And actually, one of my colleagues made one of your winter squash recipes, this amazing thing with, I think it was cider vinegar. What are some of your favorite ways to use winter squash this kind of time
of year? It's endless. You know, winter squash, and of course, there's many different, I think, also out there in the kitchen. Don't just say with the butternut squash, but there's so many, the acorn, there's so many different squashes. They all are a little bit unique. You know, they're the same, that nice pulpy, orangey, yellowy kind of texture and deliciousness, but they do have, some are more nutty, some of that. And so from soups, from appetizers, you know, whether you roast it, you grill it, you're marinated in a vinegar kind of marinade, and then you grill it, to soups, making it, pasta. I love making, you know, part of the pasta dish. You know, everybody's concerned about eating a lot of carbohydrates. Well, add more vegetables, more proteins in it, more squash. Squash and shrimps go fantastically well, you know, so making a nice sauce for pasta. Then, of course, as a side dish for a main course, roasted squash, squash puree. It's just endless, even dessert.
Now, there are a lot of things I will cook and I'm happy to cook in the world. And then I think I'm probably like a lot of home cooks. There's some things that scare me that I'm going to waste the money on this and I'm going to get it all wrong and it's going to be terrible. Give us a pep talk for taking on those challenges.
Well, Rob, if you begin with, I'm going to do it all wrong, then you go in the wrong path. You got to do, you know what? I'm going to be challenged by this. And I'm going to, and of course, I think what's you do some diligent research, you know, look up, read a little bit on the subject. Let's say that you want to cook calamari and you're not used to cooking calamari. Well, read up on it. You know, calamari, you need to know how to clean it, which is somewhat of a challenge, but they sell now beautiful calamari, clean, frozen, fresh frozen, and it's perfectly fine. And then you begin on cooking. You know, what's very important, especially with fish, is temperature. Do I cook it a lot? Do I cook it little? Do I undercook it? So the calamari is, you either cook it quick and fast, or you cook it very long to get the sauce. So, you know, once you're kind of have those guidelines, you just go and do it. And you know what, Rob? doesn't always come the best the first time. You have to try it over and over again.
It's funny you went to seafood and fish, because that's exactly what I was thinking about with intimidating, and I'm going to get it wrong.
I imagine, you know, that kind of, you know, fish, octopus and calamari, people are kind of curious about them because they are, you know, out there. This is the food of the day. But yet to cook it at home, they have a little difficulties.
Now, you're famous, of course, for Italian cooking. How do you approach maybe other types of cuisines and look for elements that you could bring in and add to your own palate?
Well, you know, I am kind of wedded to the Italian culinary tradition. And that is because I came to the United States as an immigrant at 12, was born in Italy, so very much Italian, still at home, you know, with my mother, who's 98, still alive. And we speak Italian, we speak the dialect. So, but then, being 12 and coming to America, I adopted America. You know, I'm an American. And so how do you, you know, communicate? And my gift has been, I guess, to communicate through food. I bring my native culture of food, the Italian, into the American. So therefore, I try to respect as much as possible what's truly happening in Italy, so that I communicate that in my books, on my show, in my restaurant. But I can't say that, you know, I don't experiment, you know, ginger, lemongrass. Do I put these in the Italians? I don't put them in my restaurants or in the books, but I do play with them at home.
Talking to Chef Lydia Bastianic. She's in the studio with us here in Wisconsin. Her latest book, one of many, is My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food. Last time you were on with us, we talked about My American Dream. Now you're going around the country talking to people about it. Are you hearing a lot of people maybe where this story really hits home with them? They've had similar experiences?
It does. It does, because it's my story, the real Lydia immigrant story. So I am an immigrant. And now,
and you were a refugee at one point.
Refugee. Well, let me just kind of summarize that. I come from a part of Italy, northeast of Venice, that was Italian. After World War II, Italy lost the war, and that part, Istria, the peninsula, was given to the newly formed communist Yugoslavia, and we were caught behind communism. Ultimately, it was difficult. We couldn't speak the Italian. We couldn't practice our religion. My parents decided that, you know, we needed to get out of there, escape back into Italy. And when we were back into Italy, you know, it was difficult of settling. We actually spent 2 years in a political refugee camp, and ultimately were brought here by the Catholic Relief Services. And at that time, Dwight Eisenhower was the president, and he opened immigration for people fleeing communism. That's how we came. And that's the story. But beyond that, you know, the book is, I think, you know, growing up as a young girl and with grandma, and grandma had all the courtyard animals, and where my passion for food really came, where was it born? And it was actually in those formative years with grandma on the farm with the animals, milking the goats, picking the potatoes and all of that, that my passion for food was started.
And when you talk about food and when you write about food, it's never just food. It's family, it's culture, it's traditions. That you don't cook without those things.
Well, food doesn't stand alone. You know, food needs a table and needs people around that table to appreciate it and enjoy it. Food nurtures us, keeps us alive. And it's a way of telling somebody, you know, I mean, for me, it's great pleasure cooking. I feel I nurture people. I you know, I make them happy. I give them an opportunity to communicate at the table. It makes me very happy to see people enjoy the food.
Now, you've changed my cooking. I think the first time I talked to you, you talked about saving the scraps and freezing the bread in the freezer and the water from the pasta. I do that. At this point, my wife has stopped making fun of me for having freezers full of these scraps. Any other tips like that? Any other things you like to save? Don't waste it. Use in another way.
You know, Rob, I think that common sense is sometimes overlooked, and people just say, oh, I can't cook. I can't do that. But I think in the kitchen, really think, focus on common sense. And, you know, what is it? Are you peeling the carrot? Let's say you want a carrot, you washed it. Are you peeling the peels? Could you throw it away? Well, if you wash them, they're good. You freeze them with that, with the celery leaves and whatever. Next time you make soup, you pull it all out, you put it in the pot with the chicken bones, and you got yourself a great soup.
All right, I will, and I'm guilty. I throw away, I compost, at least I compost my carrot peels.
Good.
But I'll start using those, too, again. So what, you're going to be talking at the book festival, you're talking about your book here in Wisconsin. What kind of stories are you bringing to people?
Well, you know, it's going to be like an intimate conversation with Lydia. So I will tell them a little bit about the story, intro my, because they all know Lydia, the chef. What's Lydia's real life like? And so, and they're surprised because, you know, they think that, you know, you sort of, I became a chef and this was the big success, but there was a whole track to it. And then ultimately, once I kind of, we'll open it up to questions and see what the audience would like. So it's a give and take.
Now, this is fall. It's comfort food season, especially coming into winter. What is Lydia's comfort food? What do you eat when you need that warm, sustaining, nourishing thing?
Well, I love pasta, but soups also. And this is a soup time. And so now it's mushroom, a nice mushroom soup with barley. And you know what I put in there? Some chestnuts too, very much in season.
Chestnuts.
Chestnuts with mushroom and barley, fantastic. And, you know, you sort of kind of, it really is mellow. It caresses you as you eat it. And that's a great thing that you can make a big pot. And then you freeze it, and then, you know, it sort of keeps on giving.
I've never cooked with chestnuts. Do you roast them first, or how do they go into the soup?
Well, yes. You need to either roast them or boil them, and then you peel them. And then you need to kind of cut them up because they sort of mellow into the soup, and they remain like little pieces, like beans.
Mushrooms, barley, and chestnut soup. That does sound comforting this time of year.
There you go.
Lydia, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Grazie.
That's Lydia Bastianic, chef, public television host, and, of course, author. Her newest book is My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food. If you or someone you know has ever struggled with an addiction, you probably know how hard it can be to figure out where to go for help. There are inpatient and outpatient programs, places that use alternative or holistic approaches, and support groups like Alcoholics or Narcotics Anonymous. Can be a confusing system, and figuring out how to navigate it can be challenging, especially in the middle of a crisis. Anne Fletcher is the author of a number of books, including the New York Times bestseller Sober for Good. Her new book is Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment and How to Get Help That Works. Anne, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be with you.
Well, you, for this book, went around the country. You actually went into a lot of these rehab systems with permission, saw what went on there. You interviewed people coming out of them. All rehab centers, I've learned from your book, are not created equal. Can you tell us about this kind of patchwork we have?
Oh, that's right. I said sometimes I felt like I was in the Wild West, and the experts agreed with me. I visited 15 programs, everything from, I went coast to coast. Everything from celebrity rehabs to places that treat indigent people. And I learned a lot of things, but I also offer people a lot of tips for finding what's right for them, the best kind of treatment that's out there. But one of the things that people really need to know is that most people don't recover from addictions, or what experts more correctly call substance use disorders, by going to a treatment program. Most of them recover either completely on their own by attending self-help or recovery groups such as AA, but there are many alternatives to AA, or by seeing a counselor or therapist individually. So one of the big myths that's out there is that to recover from addictions, you need to go to rehab.
And that's one of the big questions, one of many questions you tackle in the group, in the book. What is it that determines who might benefit from a rehab thing, especially an inpatient rehab facility, versus who might have a better option not with a live-in facility?
Well, there isn't really a good way to determine that ahead of time. So that's disconcerting for people to find that out. It's kind of like whichever place you go to, by the time once you walk through the door, you're probably going to wind up in that place. I recommend that people try to get an independent assessment from somebody, say a psychologist or a social worker in your community. And there are people who are working independently. This would be an independent assessment from somebody, a mental health professional who has expertise with substance use disorders, and who can give you an independent assessment about how serious your problem is. Every substance use disorder, the guidelines that we use are called the DSM, and they are now rated on when you're assessed, it would be mild, moderate, or severe. And usually only people with a severe problem, and that really is the minority of people with an addiction or substance use disorder, only the minority of people have a severe substance use disorder. Most people who are out there with a problem with drugs or alcohol, particularly alcohol, and that still is our number one killer or the problem with people, despite all that we hear about the opioid epidemic, alcohol still is the number one problem. Most people have a mild or moderate problem, not a severe problem. And if you get this independent assessment with somebody who is not tied to a rehab, who does not have a personal investment, that's the best way to go about it, because they can tell you how severe your problem is and whether or not you need to go to an outpatient program, which is really where about 9 out of 10 people wind up. And 1 out of 10 people end up in a rehab, and they're really meant for the most severe cases.
It might strike people as difficult or unusual to be, in effect, shopping for addiction treatment, but it sounds like you're saying that's part of what we should be doing. In addition to getting that that referral, also looking at the various options and figuring out what they offer and picking and choosing to the extent that we can.
It's exactly what people should be doing. One of the experts who I interviewed and who helped me with a book is Dr. Thomas McClellan, and he said, most people spend more time shopping for a vacuum cleaner or a washing machine than they do looking for addiction treatment. And, you know, that's a pretty sad state of affairs. I'm about to have back surgery, and I consulted several experts before I decided who was going to put a knife in my back. But we don't think that way. We panic. And most people, I mean, there are people who are about to die from a substance use disorder, and you need to get them help quickly. And sometimes what people do is they turn to their neighbor, they turn to somebody they know, they turn to their doctor, and many, I would say, venture to say most physicians really don't know a whole heck of a lot about addiction treatment. Most of us, when we have a problem, can take some time. It doesn't matter if you wait a few weeks or even a month to take time to find an expert in your community. I can think of several in my relatively small university town where you go to this expert who can give you an independent assessment of what you, and maybe that person turns out to be the person who you end up seeing, who can counsel you one-on-one. Because if you go to treatment, whether it's an outpatient program or a very fancy rehab, you're going to end up in groups. Some of the most prestigious programs that I went to, people were in group treatment. I figured out about 8 hours out of a 15-hour day. And I thought to myself, if I were going to send one of my young adult kids to spend $30,000 on rehab, I would never have guessed that 8 hours of that 15-hour day, we're going to be in group treatment. And that's excluding lunch and meditation groups. But that really floored me.
Talking to Ann Fletcher, her new book is Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment and How to Get Help That Works. And there's this obituary from the Burlington Free Press in Vermont that's gone viral. It's written by the mother of a young woman who died of an addiction. And I want to quote just one bit of it, very relevant to your book, quoting here, "If you work in one of the many institutions through which addicts often pass, rehabs, hospitals, jails, courts, and treat them with the compassion and respect they deserve, thank you. If instead you see a junkie or thief or liar in front of you rather than a human being in need of help, consider a new profession." So as you looked at rehab centers and other options out there, what attitude did you see?
In terms of the...
Which side of that fence people were on?
Well, it depends. I found some of the facilities that I went to were using terminology like all addicts are the same, using terms like junkies. And if you, like somebody's a junkie, people, you need to understand that this is a disorder. There's controversy about whether you want to call whether it's a disease, even though most professional organizations feel that it's a disease. I feel like let's not waste time arguing about what it is. It is, by the time somebody has a severe use disorder, I feel it's a disease. And it takes hold, and it's all the person can think about. Let's treat it with respect and recognize it that way. It's controlling a person's life at that point. And to use pejorative language, like junkie, even clean, if somebody's clean, I cringe every time I hear somebody say, he's clean and sober, or he has a dirty urine. He had a dirty urine. That suggests that when you say somebody's clean, it suggests that they were dirty when they were using. We would never say that about somebody with diabetes when they have a positive urine test. We need to stop and fight against the stigma that with which addiction, people with addiction are treated. I never refer to somebody as an addict, or I try not to use that terminology. And it's called person first language. We're fighting against it. We're A person is not a diabetic first. It's a person with diabetes.
We're talking to Ann Fletcher, author of the book Inside Rehab, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you gone through this yourself? Do you have questions about how to pick an addiction treatment option? What have your experiences been, good or bad? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We pick up our conversation with Ann Fletcher, author of the new book Inside Rehab, about how to find the best treatment for addiction, what evidence says about what works and what doesn't in addiction treatment. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe with your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, thanks for giving me the opportunity. I have very strong feelings about this, so let me just communicate what I want to communicate, which is this assessment idea, I think, only reinforces people's denial. And the reason I say that is this. We're all, as human beings, asked to be well. It's a matter of wellness. We're all at varying degrees of wellness. If a person's in a river, floating down a river toward a waterfall where that's going to kill them, you don't say to them, oh, you're fine, you're not drowning yet. The point is, what are you doing in the river? And see, people who are addicted to chemicals or whatever term you want to use, it's a matter of wellness. The only assessment that matters is the person who chooses to get well. If they go to a person and say, oh, you're fine, your drinking isn't bothering your lifestyle, alcohol is a toxin. That's not you're not well if you're drinking alcohol. So my point is, don't reinforce people's denial by couching it in, well, it's not really necessary for them to go to treatment. We all need treatment, in my opinion.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Ann, what do you think of what Jeff had to say?
Well, it's a question of degree. And, you know, many times I found that people were forced to go to treatment, and if the treatment isn't right for the person, they're going to, he's using the word denial. If it's not the right fit or the right type of treatment for the person, they're going to resist it and they're going to walk away. And it's not always a question of denial. It's finding treatment that's right for the person. And many times a person does better. I remember one woman told me that she was forced to go to a very prominent program where all the treatment was group-based. And she was extremely shy. She was forced to tell the people, one of the sayings that's often used in addiction treatment, traditional 12-step-based treatment. And I'm not opposed to that because it works for many people, but you have to find what's right for you. And she had been forced to go to that kind of treatment before. She went to it again. And there's a saying that you're only as sick as your secrets. And she was forced to reveal things about her history that made her very uncomfortable in front of other people. And it had to do with her sex life in the past. And she was extremely shy. And she said, I've never shared in group with other people. And she finally found a program after not doing well in that program. And often people were told, it's you, you're not getting the program, it's you. And in fact, it wasn't her. The program was not the right fit. And I heard this over and over again. She finally found a program where the treatment was largely one-on-one. The counselors, almost all of them, had a PhD in psychology, and she was able to, she said, I finally felt that I belonged at this place because I didn't have to disclose things about myself that were very intimate in front of a group. When I talked to her, she was getting her PhD in psychology. And that leads me to something else that's very important. Many people don't know that many programs, and there have been studies about what goes on nationwide in addiction treatment, many of the counselors don't even have to have a college degree. And when we're talking about addiction, we're talking about some of the sickest people who are being treated by some of the least trained professionals in any kind of profession. And many experts I talked to said that people should have at least a master's degree to be treating people with addiction. People with substance use disorders, to use the proper term, often have co-occurring mental health problems. And by the time somebody gets to an inpatient program, that most of them have co-occurring mental health problems in addition to their addiction. And they often do not get the psychological or psychiatric treatment that they need to go along with their substance use disorder. So it's important to ask about the credentials of the people who will be providing most of your care when you go into treatment.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Go next to Angie with us in Milwaukee. Angie, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I just wanted to
say that I have been a patient in multiple facilities for drug abuse. And when I listen to you talk and the way that you dissect how the patient feels, I think is the most important part. If you are not worried about the patient and just constantly concerned with what their problem is, you will never fix that patient. When HIV was an issue, people were treated with great disrespect. They were treated like some sort of plague, and that's how people are treating addiction today.
Angie, have you found a program or a treatment that did better than what you're talking about?
I am just now in a program that I have started a couple of months ago that has finally started to work for me. And for the first time, my provider said something very, very, very important. He said, you are not an addict, you are sick. And I've never heard anyone say that. I've heard it on the radio. I've heard other people talk about these magical doctors. But he wants to see CT scans of my brain. He wants to study what my body is going through individually. And I don't have private insurance. This guy is doing this out of the goodness and pocket of his heart. And hopefully the studies that he's doing on me can help someone else.
Angie, thank you so much for sharing your story, and I hope this treatment works out for you. And Angie is not the first one to tell you that story, I'm guessing.
No, and it's, you know, I was fortunate after I finished the book to be, even though I'm not a licensed, I'm not credentialed as an addiction counselor, I was hired as an educator at a unique addiction treatment program called Minnesota Alternatives. And they really work with the individual. There certainly was some group treatment, and I was hired to run some of the groups to teach people about how to better meet their psychological needs. They were skills groups, but the program was not built on the 12 steps. We encouraged people to go to outside groups of their own choosing if they wanted to. But the work with the counselors, most of whom had master's degrees, where they were trained in a unique way. Most of them also had degrees in mental health. They really worked with the patients, the clients, one on one, to help them individually come up with their own way of dealing with their addiction or substance use disorder. And it sounds like our caller has found something that will work for her. And we really let the client come up with, they often, people know what will work and will not work for them. And, you know, when you're trying to get a person to, you know, to put on a shoe that's not the right size, which I heard so often when people went to the went to programs and they were blamed that, you know, it's you, it's not the program. But many times I found that it was a one-size-fits-all approach. And if you think about it, we have many, many different approaches to deal with high blood pressure, many different approaches to deal with depression. And the same thing should apply to dealing with addiction, that we offer many different approaches and let the client tell the counselor, this did not work for me in the past, but this sounds like something that will really work for me, and let them try and find their own way.
Angie, thanks again for the call. And let's talk about access. Do we have enough effective treatment options with credentialed people who use evidence-based approaches to meet the needs of people addicted to alcohol, opioids, you name it?
Absolutely not. One of the things that I found, unfortunately, was that there's a huge gap between science and practice. And there have been research studies on this where an expert named Dr. Carroll from Yale had people actually, she took recording sessions, she recorded sessions of counselors with clients. And she said a lot of what went on with clients was quote-unquote chat, checking in with clients, a lot of winging it, a lot of going to the computer to Google worksheets before they went to group, a lot of educational lectures and films. And these are some of the least effective ways to treat people with substance problems. And they were not using evidence-based approaches like cognitive behavioral approaches. They were leaving the family out of treatment. Families, we have evidence approaches for families. One of the most effective approaches, which I was lucky enough to use with, I ran a co-led a group with a counselor called CRAFT, which stands for Community Reinforcement and Family Training. Only an academic can come up with a name like that. But if you could find a program that uses the CRAFT approach, which helps the family communicate better with the person with addiction. There are evidence-based approaches, but they're being used very seldom in most programs that are out there.
We'll leave it there for now. Anne, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm happy to be with you.
That was Anne Fletcher, author of the new book, Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment and How to Get Help That Works. She shared her research and her experience visiting a number of different addiction treatment facilities around the country, expensive, low income, and all points in between, and how to navigate the addiction treatment system when you or a loved one is looking for help. Still time to share your story. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR at Central Time WPR or email ideas at WPR.org. Milwaukee has its famous Fonzie statue, and now the city of South Milwaukee is on its way to a new iconic landmark with a statue of the legendary pro wrestler, Da Crusher. This week, South Milwaukee's City Council approved a location for a new statue of the late Reggie Lizowski, a.k.a. The Crusher. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the bronze statue will be the end result of a crowdfunding campaign to honor the South Milwaukee wrestler. Lizowski entered the world of professional wrestling in 1949, starting off a 40-year career in the ring. Checking his birth date and doing some quick maths, that means he was still wrestling at age 63. He wrestled as a tag team partner with Dick the Bruiser, and the team appeared in a 1974 movie, The Wrestler, starring Ed Asner. He became a national champion in a bunch of different wrestling leagues and a local legend in South Milwaukee. He passed away in 2005. The next step for the new statue, architectural plans, they're expected to be completed in the next month and a half or so. And then I'm guessing the statue goes up next year. Looking forward to seeing you send some pictures of you and the Crusher side by side. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.